I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. Baltimore City's police department fields hundreds of citizen complaints against officers every year. Most are dismissed, and the civilian and the officer never meet face-to-face. Soon they'll have that chance. The city is launching a voluntary mediation program. We'll talk with Changa Onyango, Executive Director of Community Mediation in Baltimore, and Sister Allison McCrary, Director of a community police mediation effort already operating in New Orleans. Then, Baltimore and Prince George's County now offer drug users clean needles. Should needle exchange be expanded throughout Maryland? Or does it divert resources from what most view as the direct way to end addiction, residential treatment? Plus, Joanna Sullivan is here with the Baltimore Business Journal's top stories, and WTMD Scott Mullins has the scoop on live music at the airport. Midday's News Roundup, First News. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm very glad that you are with us. Later in the hour, we'll talk with former heroin addict and former Baltimore County drug czar Mike Gimbel and with Delegate Clarence Lamb of Baltimore and Howard Counties about a proposal to expand needle exchange programs throughout the state. Joanna Sullivan, editor of the Baltimore Business Journal, will be here to catch us up on the week's business headlines, and we'll chat with WTMD Program Director and Interim General Manager Scott Mullins about live music at the baggage carousel. But first, last year, Baltimore City's Police Department handled 799 citizen complaints against police officers. Nearly all of them were for non-criminal matters, and nearly all were dismissed without the civilian and the officer ever meeting face-to-face. Within the next few weeks, civilians and police officers will have the opportunity to take a different approach. Baltimore City is launching a mediation program specifically to handle citizen complaints against police. And here with me in the studio to explain the process, tell us some more about it, is Changa Onyango. He's Executive Director of Community Mediation in Baltimore, which will provide the trained mediators for the new program. Welcome to the show.
Good afternoon, Sheila. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you? Joining us by phone is Sister Allison McCrary, Mediation Program Director for the New Orleans Office of the Independent Police Monitor, a community police mediation program that is already in operation. Sister Allison, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I wasn't thinking. I told Changa he didn't need to wear his headphones, but of course he does. That's how he can hear Sister Allison. Changa, why mediation in the citizen complaint cases?
Well, mediation is a very important tool that the city is going to need if it plans to come back to a place of unification between bureaucrats and politicians and institutions and corporate entities and its citizenry. And the way mediation works is it creates a neutral space, which is really a difficult space to find in a city like this. And it creates a neutral space where people feel safe to say what they need to say. And this is something that's it's kind of counterintuitive. You would think that, you know, if the sidewalk would be a neutral space, but it's really not. Because if there's an officer, he's the city, you know, and if it's city property, then the city property is not a neutral space, right?
But it's public property.
It is public property, but in the way that we treat, in the way that we move, if a citizen is on the public property, then he's in the domain of an officer.
So you've taken us immediately to the question of the physical space of the mediation. Where do you intend to do these mediations?
Mediations, thank God for our partners. We have about 80 partners around the city. And our partners allow us to use their boardrooms or their conference rooms and different spaces in churches and nonprofits and schools around the city. And we have kind of curated and guarded these relationships because we want, one of our main tenets is to be able to do mediation where the conflict has occurred, in a neutral space in that geographic area, so that it's convenient, and also in a place where the participants will be able to feel comfortable.
So Well, first of all, tell me the kinds of, in very brief form, the kinds of mediations that you're already involved in.
Oh, we don't have that much time. but we do a very important service for people who are in a pre-release status from being incarcerated. That means they're close to coming out. So we are able to, we've worked with DPSC to be able to bring
Department of
Public Safety,
Society and Corrections,
to be able to bring residents in and do mediation inside so that they have a soft landing, so to speak. We work in schools. We're working in 20 schools now, thanks to the chief of school supports, Carl Perry. And then we also do general community ones, and we have the state's attorney office that refers to us. So we do a lot of work.
So give me a picture. Once the police community mediation program gets underway, mm-hmm. give me a picture of how that's going to work.
Well, currently, as you said in the intro, people wait 6 months to a year just to hear some vague answer. Maybe it's sustained, maybe it's unsustained. But on the civilian side, they don't know what that means, right? That's not really well explained. And for privacy's sake, the Officer's Bill of Rights says that we don't have to explain what penalties have happened to the officer, if any at all. So from the civilian side, they really have no outcome. It's just something that has allowed that anger or that emotion to subside because it took 6 months to a year. And from the officer's side, it's really unfair, some of the way that the current process works, because they may not even be informed because the investigation is going on, right? So they might not even be informed 6 months to a year that there ever was a case. So they, you know, some argument you had back in the summertime and it's wintertime, and, you know, somebody comes and asks you about it, and you're like, what are you talking about as an officer? And then that case stays in your jacket for 3 years, even whether it's sustained or unsustained. So it's a thing where, you know, it's really not effective for either side to get closure, or and it actually adds to some of the malice between the two sides.
Let's talk to Sister Allison about how it's working in New Orleans. Sister, the mediation program in New Orleans has been operating for 2 years, right? A similar model to what Changa Onyanga is talking about here in Baltimore.
Yes, it has. And, you know, Baltimore and New Orleans are so similar. We really are sister cities. Mm-hmm. We, you know, face the same social problems with a lot of poverty, a lot of crime, a lot of violence. And you know, when we face similar ideas about how to solve those problems, and this is creating the structures and the processes that can create the systemic change that we're looking for and that can rebuild trust back in our police departments and to democratize policing so that the community can tell the police, this is what we want police to do in our neighborhood. This is what we don't want police to do in our neighborhood. This is what violence looks like to me. This is what safety looks like to me. And it's really been a privilege to work with Community Mediation Baltimore and to share in our reciprocal learnings as we work to look at these issues and to create community solutions to address these systemic problems that we face.
Absolutely. Well, as I understand it, New Orleans has about the same order of magnitude of citizen complaints that Baltimore City does, about 600 a year, correct?
Correct.
In New Orleans.
Yeah, yeah.
And what proportion of these civilian complaints against police are mediated?
Yeah, so with any new program, it takes time to develop and to grow and for people to trust the program and for departments to become accustomed to referring civilian-initiated complaints to mediation. And I use the word civilian, even though it sounds like a more military term, because we also work with non-citizens, folks who are undocumented in our city who can also file complaints of alleged police misconduct. So in our first year, we had about 27 mediations of civilian-initiated complaints. And it takes a while for a program to go, to start. And, for example, New York City, they also have a community police mediation program. And in their first year, they had 2 mediations. In their second year, they had about 4 mediations. Mm-hmm. Now they have more than 400 mediations a year between civilians and police officers.
Well, let me ask Changa Onyanga, how many would you expect in Baltimore, and what are you geared up to handle?
Well, citywide, we have a pool of volunteer mediators. All our mediations are conducted by volunteers. And so we're working with an active pool of about 60, 65 mediators if it fluxes. So we expect to be able to handle everything that's thrown at us. Keisha Brown, who is the director of the Office of Civil Rights and Wage Enforcement, and her office have hired a mediator who will coordinate these cases. And so all of the ones that are appropriate will come to us.
Now, and who decides what's appropriate?
Well, that's a combination between the Citizens Review Board and IAD. So they work together.
IAD.
Internal Affairs. So they work together to determine which cases will be appropriate. And it's usually going to be something where, it's not a crime that the officer has committed, but more like a misuse of the officer's discretion or a perceived disrespect. And this type of thing, which is the overwhelming majority of the cases,
and it's voluntary. Both sides have
always
to agree
voluntary.
This is the way they want to proceed with this.
Yes, always voluntary. That's one of our big three. Must be voluntary. Must be completely confidential. And mediators must be neutral.
Sister Allison McCrary, what complaints are not sent to the mediation program in New Orleans? What? Give me an example of some the kinds of complaints that are not appropriate for mediation.
Sure. So complaints that relate to any excessive use of force. If an officer used force on a civilian, that would not be appropriate for mediation. And any kind of complaint that alleges an action that could result in a lawsuit if there was damage to a person, damage to property. The majority of cases that go to mediation at the moment relate to professionalism, discourtesy, or minor neglect of duty. So a lot of traffic stops where the officer was rude or the officer didn't fully explain why the person was pulled over. And a lot of it relates to communication and through mediation and having this safe space to authentically share face-to-face with the officer, with the civilian, you can have these honest and meaningful conversations and rebuild the relationship and rebuild the trust that was broken during that interaction.
Right.
And what we're finding from after these mediations and the survey results that we're seeing is that, you know, nearly all of the civilians who participated in mediation said that they would share information about crime in their neighborhood with that officer who participated in the mediation.
Right.
Whereas beforehand they wouldn't. So we see how it affects, you know, this larger system of what's going on our streets relating to crime and violence. And it also gives the officer, you know, a safe space to be fully human and to apologize if they want to. You know, I also teach at the New Orleans Police Academy, and, you know, they're taught to put up this guard. And most of the officers walk into a mediation, and they have the palm of their hands as tight up into their armpits as possible when they walk into their room with their arms crossed over their chest.
Right.
And they have this guard up, you know, and it's like to create a safe space where they can be human, where they can let that guard down and have this honest and frank conversation in a confidential, non-judgmental space.
That's Sister Allison McCrary, who is Mediation Program Director of a community police mediation program in New Orleans that has been operating for about 2 years. I'm Sheila Cast here on Midday on WIPR, and with me in the studio is Changa Onyango, Executive Director of a community mediation in Baltimore, which is about to start a program mediating citizen complaints against police. Changa, since most complaints at this point, citizen complaints, are dismissed, what is the incentive for a police officer to take part in this program, which sounds like it takes a fair amount of involvement, emotional energy, if nothing else, when just on the percentages, the likelihood is this complaint is just going to go away?
Mm-hmm. So a couple things. One, there is if the officer agrees and volunteers to come in and have a mediation, he's guaranteed that the complaint won't go any further, right? So it's according to the LEOBR, which is the Officer's Bill of Rights, the complaint will stay in the jacket for 3 years. But if he goes to mediation, it's guaranteed that it will be unsustained. So that's one. The second thing is many times these officers have to be in that neighborhood. And left unchecked, relationships that have gotten off to a rocky start, perhaps to something trivial, tend to, over a year, 6 months, 2 years that you may be in that district, tend to balloon in a negative direction. So both of those things are thwarted if you go to mediation.
I think for some of our listeners, perhaps the elephant in the room is racial tensions between the community and police officers.
Mm-hmm.
How do you expect this to affect that?
Well, the biggest thing about race is that it was created to make an us and a them. The biggest thing about mediation is it was created to make a us only. So if I'm a human and you're a human and you're allowed to sit in a chair and hear me agree, you know, I felt violated in that moment, right? There's no way, and the inclusive mediation model is so powerful because you're saying, you know, from your filter, you know, you did this, you did that, and you've got that point going on. But a mediator is going to say, sounds like you felt violated. Sounds like you value order, right? Well, those are things that the officer on the other side, he can hear that. And there's this electric moment that happens during a mediation when I land on the word that really represents how you feel. And you as a mediation participant on either side of the table say, yes, that's exactly what it is. And when that happens, it's an electric piece that happens in the room and anybody can feel it. And what it does is it manages to break that under the arm palm.
He's acting it out here. He's got his arms tightly across his chest. We do have to wrap this up. Sister Allison, can you give us a brief idea? I know you've only been operating for about 2 years, but do you see a change? Can you describe briefly a change in the tenor of police community relations in New Orleans as a result of this mediation effort?
Yeah, and, you know, New Orleans has a very comprehensive federal consent decree. We had a police department with so many problems. And so, you know, before the Puerto Rico consent decree, the consent decree in New Orleans was the most comprehensive in any department in the country. And so a lot of reforms and changes have been made. So I can't say it's, you know, just to the mediation, but what I can say is that the responses that we hear from the lieutenants, sergeants, and police officers and community members, the feedback that they give us about the mediation program is so transformative. Mm. You know, we had one sergeant who said, you know, I'm a white, old male police officer, and I've been on this force for decades, and I've never had to talk about race until I encountered this, mm-hmm. you know, in mediation when race came up, and we talked about it. And, you know, and he goes, I never had to talk about that before, and there were such great learnings, and he's been, you know, sharing all about his new learnings about race and in his work and how it affects him. You know, for decades he never had to talk about that or look at that in a real way.
This is
and communicate about it.
I can see why you're both excited about
yeah.
it, and I appreciate you both telling us about it. Sister Allison McCrary is Mediation Program Director for Community Police Mediation Program in New Orleans that's been operating for about 2 years. Changa Onyango is Executive Director of Community Mediation in Baltimore, which is about to launch a mediation program for citizen complaints against police in Baltimore. Changa, what's your timeline? When does this get started?
Well, we've already identified the first couple of cases, so we'll start getting some results here soon.
I hope we can keep in touch with you as this develops. Thank you so much.
I'm here.
Thank you both.
Great. Thank you.
And we have to take a quick break here. When we come back, we'll talk about needle exchange programs. Are they another tool in the fight to end addiction, or are they diverting resources away from ending addiction? And later in the show, we'll get the Baltimore Business Journal's top stories for the week, and we'll talk about what may be Baltimore's hottest new music venue, BWI's Luggage Carousel. I'm Sheila Cast. Short break now. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. As part of the budget deal made at the end of last year, Congress lifted its ban on federal funding for needle exchange programs. While funds may not be used for actual syringes, money can go towards staff salaries, counseling, bands to distribute supplies and outreach efforts. Federal funding for needle exchange programs was first banned by Congress in 1988. President Obama lifted the ban in 2009, but Congress reinstated it in 2011, and now it's been lifted again. In Maryland, only Baltimore City and Prince George's County are authorized to run programs that offer drug users clean syringes. Earlier this week, legislation to permit expansion of needle exchanges throughout the state was introduced in the House by Democratic Delegate Clarence Lamb, who represents parts of Howard and Baltimore counties. He's also Dr. Lamb. He is a preventive medicine physician on the faculty of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and he's here with me in the studio. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
As a physician, what is your view of exchange programs?
I think exchange services programs are a really basic public health measure to help reduce the spread of HIV, hepatitis, and other infectious diseases, as well as get people who inject drugs into treatment. And so it's a really strong public health measure that we really need in our toolbox to be able to help people who are addicted to drugs.
Proponents like yourself, I think, point to needle exchanges as a way to build relationships and eventually connect addicts to treatment services. What other services would be available besides exchanging needles?
So there are a whole slew of wraparound services that are part of syringe services programs, which is why we actually use the term syringe services programs. We understand that there's a lot more than simply the exchange or return of needles, and this includes wound care that would be provided to folks who inject drugs. This would be TB testing, STD testing, counseling, and there are many programs that offer these types of services. Baltimore City has a very strong program that provides these types of services to people who inject drugs, and for many of them, this is actually their only access to the healthcare system. There have been research and studies that show that for programs in California, for example, 75% of the users in a program like this, that's their only access to the healthcare system. They don't access the healthcare system any other way. And so this is important for them to be able to receive these medical services as well.
So what your legislation would do would be to...
So this legislation, HB 468, will allow and enable local jurisdictions to be able to start syringe services programs, be that from the local health department or community-based organizations. And these programs will help link people who inject drugs to a range of substance abuse treatment and other critical health services, and also provide syringe injection equipment, as well as collect non-sterile syringes from folks.
Why does there need to be state authorization of this?
So there needs to be state authorization because syringes are considered drug paraphernalia. You need a prescription to be able to get syringes, and that's why you need a law to be able to allow people without prescriptions to be able to access clean syringes.
And as I understand it, in 2014, the General Assembly repealed the requirement that Baltimore City limit exchanges of used syringes to a one-for-one basis.
Correct.
Your legislation, what would it say statewide? One-to-one exchange? Or?
So my legislation will allow for expanded distribution, so not simply a one-for-one exchange. The Baltimore City program has been incredibly effective moving into an expanded distribution system, and this has allowed them to be able to provide additional syringes to people so that they can even further reduce the spread of infectious diseases like HIV and hepatitis.
It's Delegate Clarence Lamb, a physician here on Midday on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the possibility of expanding needle exchange programs in Maryland, and I want to pull somebody else into the conversation. Joining us by phone is Mike Gimbel, the former director of Baltimore County's Office of Substance Abuse. He is also a former heroin addict, and now Mike Gimbel consults for substance abuse programs. Mike Gimbel, welcome to Midday.
Hi, Sheila. How are you?
I'm fine. You have a different view of needle exchange programs.
Yeah, I really do. And, you know, while it's argued that needle exchange may slow down the spread of HIV, I believe the clean needle programs are inherently destructive because they address only one symptom of the problem, but it gives the illusion to the public that it's actually solving the drug addiction problem. And the only thing that will really change the behavior of an addict is long-term treatment. And I don't hear anyone, including Delegate Lamb, the mayor, the governor, advocating and paying for more treatment. Everybody talks about treatment. Well, this will help them get into treatment. Narcan will bring them back from an overdose so we can get them into treatment. There isn't any treatment in the state of Maryland. It's very rare and difficult to find, yet they will advocate for needle exchange and harm reduction and all the programs, but no one's advocating to actually have treatment available to people. So I think it really gives a false sense. The other thing is the fact that...
Hold on a minute. Hold that thought. You've just said a whole lot, and I want to hear what you're about to say, but I also want to give Delegate Lamb a chance to respond to what you've said so far. Really no treatment available in Maryland?
There is treatment available in Maryland. Of course, we would like there to be more programs and services available to people who inject drugs. But the goal of needle exchange is multifold, and one of them is to help link people who inject drugs to substance abuse treatment. And the data, the research that's been shown out there, a lot of this has been done at Johns Hopkins, has shown that up to 20% of people who inject drugs here in Baltimore City and utilize the program do actually access and refer themselves to treatment because of the syringe service program that the city has. And so the evidence bears that out. There are a lot of myths out there when it comes to syringe services programs, like it'll increase drug use, that it could facilitate other additional substance abuse, that it could lead to increased use of other drugs and additional needles in neighborhoods. A lot of this has been dispelled by research that has been done here in Baltimore based on the Baltimore City program, because it's been longstanding. It's a 20-year program.
Let me just pick up on one of those, and I don't pretend to any expertise, and I can hear that Mike Gimbel is trying to jump in also. I mean, you said it's a myth that a needle exchange encourages drug use. You could persuade me that it would. I mean, it seems like if the paraphernalia that actually gets the drug into somebody's system is more available, that could encourage drug use. Mike Gimbel, there was something you wanted to jump in.
First of all, the delegate is very, very wrong. I've been in this business here at Baltimore for 35 years. I get phone calls every single day. I work with addicts every day. There is not even one-hundredth of enough treatment in the state of Maryland. He is totally wrong, and it's embarrassing that we don't have treatment in Maryland. Secondly, if it was such a successful program, and the delegate is right, it's been in Baltimore for a long time, but is the heroin problem any better in Baltimore? Is HIV rate down? Is Hep C rates down? Overdose down? Absolutely not. Because, very simply, Sheila, a heroin addict loves their needle. They get used to the needle. They're not going to wait to get a clean needle to shoot up. That's not what an addict does. An addict only wants more drugs. They're not worried about their health. They're not worried about the law. They're not worried about hurting anyone. They want their drug. And the only thing that'll change that behavior is to get them into some kind of long-term treatment, not to reinforce their addiction by giving them clean needles and bringing them back from overdoses. That just reinforces the fact that they're loving their life by shooting up and using drugs.
Well, wait a minute. Let me again inject the thoughts of someone who is not at all an expert in this. Two things. I think I never thought of needle exchanges as actually ending addiction. I thought of it as a way to prevent spread of disease like hepatitis and HIV. So again, I don't know what you folks who think about this long and hard, but please address me as an uninformed reader of this kind of news. Am I wrong? Do people actually, is that actually an argument? The other thing that Mike Gimbel, when you let me ask you each to deal with that first. I mean, is needle exchange really, does anybody posit it as a way to end addiction or just to stop the spread of disease? Delegate Lamb?
I don't think it's meant to be a mechanism or a tool by which to end addiction. I think it's a program and a service that we have to be able to reduce the transmission of infectious diseases like HIV and hepatitis, and also prevent overdose deaths. We recognize that there's a rising epidemic of heroin and opioid addiction, and there needs to be a multi-pronged approach. This is not the silver bullet. This is not the only thing that should be tried. But as a physician, I like to base my evidence. I do base my evidence, my decisions on evidence and on science. And that's how I base my policy decisions as a legislator. And the evidence here from published data and literature shows that it does not increase crime. It does not increase needles in neighborhoods. It doesn't facilitate other drug abuse. It doesn't lead to an increased rise in children using drugs. And so we need to make sure that these programs are available to people who inject drugs so that we can get link them to treatment.
But it does cost money. And is Mike Gimble right when he says that's money that we shouldn't be putting into this? We should be putting this at least into some more treatment spots.
So syringe services programs are incredibly cost effective. If you look at the lifetime treatment costs of drugs and doctor's visits of someone who's infected with HIV, you're talking about medical bills that would run close to $400,000 in an individual's lifetime. The syringe service program here in Baltimore City, 1 year's budget costs in the range of $700,000 to $800,000. So if you're able to prevent two cases of HIV in 1 year, you've already paid for the program in and of itself. And we see that in programs throughout the country, that it is incredibly effective and cost effective in reducing the spread of HIV, because when you look at the drugs and the treatment that's needed for HIV and Hep C, it is incredibly expensive.
Mike Gimble, I cut you off a few minutes ago when you were about to make a point.
No, that's okay. I've worked at the school of at the Bloomberg School. I did a lot of consulting there as well. And what I've always tried to teach physicians and delegates like Delegate Lamb is how a drug addict, a heroin addict, actually thinks. What do they believe and how do they think? And what motivates them to use or not use? And what they don't understand, it's like an intellectual pipe dream. Well, let's make this available and all the heroin addicts will get clean needles. They won't use dirty needles. That's not the way an addict thinks. When I had a needle, I would save my needle like most heroin addicts do. Because when you're out of drugs, you actually scrape that needle looking for a little bit of dope. That's what addicts do.
So you're saying when you were using, you preferred a dirty needle. You preferred a used needle.
Because an addict, and the delegate needs to learn this, that the addicts have a relationship with their needle. I mean, that's like their friend. They keep it with them at all times.
So we were talking earlier about evidence. Is the evidence of needle exchange programs that the clean syringes sit there untaken, that nobody's using them?
I mean, again, you know, what I've heard is that there's more needles on the street that are being sold, that are being used, that kids get their hands on because they're lying around in the streets. And we put them, more of these out on the streets because, again, we're not changing any behavior here. Believe me, Baltimore City has been doing needle exchange and Narcan and all these programs for years, yet the problem has gotten worse. That's all the data I need to show that whatever we're doing is really not working.
Let me put one other thing on the table, because we're going to have to wrap this conversation up. But just today, Delegate Dan Morheim of Baltimore County, who's also a physician, is introducing a package of bills to shift resources away from criminal punishment for drug use. The package includes bills to decriminalize small amounts of drugs, to require on-demand drug treatment at acute care hospitals, to establish programs where people can go to use drugs in a safe environment, and to create a pilot program permitting special clinics to treat some addicts with pharmaceutical-grade opioids. As I said, we've got almost no time. I'd just like each of you briefly to tell me, Delegate Lamb, how does this package, as well as your bill, fit into an overall state effort to address rising opioid use?
I think it gets back to the fact that we need a multi-pronged approach to substance use and addiction, and these are all a series of policy initiatives, including syringe services programs, that will help link people to treatment and to get them the help that they need. I think the allegation that people want to use clean or want to use dirty needles is really a ridiculous one. If you look at the Baltimore City program, we have data that shows that up to 30% of people come from outside the city to utilize the Baltimore City program because they want to have clean needles. And so this is a program that will help people.
Mike Kimball, I'll give you the last word if you can do it. If you can do
it
quickly.
Yeah, I'll do it very quickly. First of all, I don't agree. I think that addicts keep their needles. But I still think, again, every comment made by Dan Morheim, every comment is made is that we will refer people to treatment. We will refer people to treatment, but we don't have the treatment. Dan Morheim's package of setting up drug-using sites and legalizing is absolutely insane. You know, it's just ridiculous, and it should be laughed out of the legislature. It's a waste of time. We should be focusing way more energy on opening up long-term treatment centers in this state, because unless we have treatment, all these other programs are going to be useless and won't work.
This is obviously a conversation that we need to continue another time, but I'm grateful to you both for at least giving
sure.
us a start on it. Mike Kimball, former Baltimore County drug czar, former heroin addict, and now a consultant with substance abuse organizations, and Delegate Clarence Lamb, Democrat of Howard and Baltimore counties, sponsor of a bill that would permit expansion of needle exchange programs throughout the state. Thank you both.
Sure.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we need to take a break. When we come back, business headlines from the Baltimore Business Journal. We'll hear about a stalled development at Cross Street Market, major donation for a new rec center in East Baltimore, and the rise of comic book sales. And also we'll hear from Scott Mullins of WTMD about a monthly live music series at BWI Airport. All that when we come back. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everyone. I'm Sheila Cast. We had a range of interesting business developments to talk about this week. Under Armour CEO Kevin Plank makes a major donation. Development at Cross Street Market in Federal Hill hits another snag. Bids to buy Baltimore's Metro West complex are in. And comic books hit the mainstream. Joanna Sullivan, editor-in-chief of the Baltimore Business Journal, is here to tell us what it all means. Welcome back to the show, Joanna.
Thanks for having me, Sheila.
So let's start with Kevin Plank. What is this major donation that he made?
$5 million. It's going to redevelop the Carmelo Anthony Center, which is no longer called that in East Baltimore, into a community center, a place where kids will have program, recreation. There are going to be fields. There's going to be a community kitchen. So it'll be a place where people can gather and have some great programming. And Living Classrooms is running that, and they do a great job with offering all kinds of programs in other places in the city.
So what is the programming that we expect there?
It will be, you know, geared towards sports and technology. There's going to be a STEM area of the building as well.
Science, technology, engineering, and math?
Yes.
Like classes or
computer,
projects?
Computer classes. You know, the program isn't out there yet, but they have lots of plans for that. They'll have, you know, sports program, probably yoga if it follows the same pattern as they have. Living Classrooms runs a center in Patterson Park that offers a whole bunch of different programming for the community, kids and adults.
And so this is $5 million both for physical rehab and programming?
There will be some other programming money as well that is going towards there. And so, you know, it should be interesting to see, you know, that develop. It'll be a great addition to the community there.
There's another project the BBJ wrote about under the Plank name, this time Scott Plank, Kevin's older brother, who has been involved in development at Cross Street Market. It got the third extension by the Baltimore Public Markets Corporation this week. What is the ultimate vision here, and why have things been moving so slowly?
We are trying to find out exactly why things are moving so slowly, but it's basically trying to hammer out agreement between the city and the developers. They're at odds on some issues.
Like what? Do we know?
You know, not positive exactly, but, you know, we're hearing things, you know, it might have to do with, you know, whether or not the market will stay open during the process. You know, what do you do with existing tenants?
It's a pretty old.
There's money that's involved as well. You know, how much the developers will pay the city, you know, to operate the market. It will still be city property. And they have a great vision to turn it into, you know, a much more, you know, you can't see the the rendering on the radio, but into a much more modern-looking facility with a greenhouse where they're going to grow vegetables, where they will sell those vegetables. You know,
so as of now, what looks to be the timeline? I mean, is there any sense of when it would be moving? Because it's not a lot of vacancies now, right?
It has some vacancies. There's still some stalls, you know, that have been there forever, and it's still a very, you know, vibrant market in many ways. But I used to live in the neighborhood and shop there all the time, and it's really has you don't see as much foot traffic in there. You definitely don't see as many vendors. But it's still an integral part of the neighborhood, and people are excited to see, you know, see it get redeveloped. If you've been in there, you know, it's old and it definitely needs a lot of work. But they want to basically build a new structure.
Let's move to the west side of town. The Metro West facility has received bids for redevelopment. Catch us up on that project.
Sure. This is another Caves Valley. It could be another Caves Valley project. They were the high bidder. They're also involved in the Cross Street Market project. They bid $7.1 million to buy the development. It's the former Social Security Administration on Green Street. It spans a couple blocks. It's huge. So it could be really interesting to see what happens there.
And again, on that one, what's the next step? What kind of?
Well, you know, it's up to the government, you know, mm-hmm. which bidder wins, you know, how that all plays out. So we'll keep you posted on that.
Is there a deadline for a decision?
Well, GSA, the General Services Administration, expects to make a decision or reject the offer within 60 days from January 27th.
So stay tuned. We'll know this spring.
Yeah, moving, you know, quickly. It would be an interesting development in that part of the city.
And lastly, tell us about BBJ's cover story this week. It's titled, Buying Comics is Not the Secret Shame Anymore.
Yes, and our inside headline was Nerds Strike Back. With all the Star Wars hype, and you had Ant-Man and Guardians of the Galaxy, all these movies based on comic book sales are really spiking. Diamond Comics, which is based here in Baltimore, which is like the biggest distributor of comics, saw like 6 million copies increase this year, like 98 million they sold. We have a lot of independent comic book stores in the Baltimore area. We talked to a bunch of them, and they said that comics are really popular, and they're also becoming more mainstream. It used to be kind of the realm of the nerd, but now everyone is into them.
And superheroes and films based on comic strips are a big part of this?
Yes, that's a really big part. Star Wars is really driving a lot of it, obviously. The new movie.
Yeah.
And the comics associated with that. But also a lot of the other movies that have been out in the last few years.
But, I mean, Baltimore sees a huge turnout for Comic-Con each year. I mean, is Baltimore a particular center of nerd appetite? Nerd culture.
Baltimore has a reputation for having a lot of, you know, besides the fact that it has a lot of homegrown comic book stores, but a lot of fans. Our writer who wrote this, Jonathan Munchaw, who's our associate editor, he goes to Comic-Con. He's a huge comic book person.
Are you saying Jonathan is a nerd?
I didn't say that, Jonathan,
you did
if
not.
You're listening.
She did not. Let the record show. That was me, not Joanna. Well, that sounds like a fun cover story.
It was a lot of fun. It's a great business story, great opportunity for, you know, for our readers who want to maybe attract some of those people that obviously have money to spend on comics.
I really appreciate you telling us about it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Sheila. Have a good weekend.
Joanna Sullivan is editor-in-chief of the Baltimore Business Journal. Yeah, you have a great weekend, too. You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Over the past year, one Friday evening a month, travelers passing through Baltimore's BWI Thurgood Marshall Airport have encountered an unexpected welcome, live music. WTMD has partnered with the airport to bring free local music to the baggage carousel. And with us now in studio to talk about this unusual venue is Scott Mullins, Program Director and Interim General Manager of WTMD. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Sheila.
Where did this idea come from?
Well, BWI had been doing some live music programming prior to our involvement, but they wanted to really explore Baltimore's growing reputation for innovative, creative, original music. So they contacted us, and we met with them and course, we loved the idea. They were willing to turn the programming and the curating over to us, and it's what we do. So we started in January 15. We've had some great bands. Yes, exactly. Uh-huh. So we're entering our second full year, and it has been a lot of fun. It's taken a little while to get off the ground, sort of explain the concept to people, but it's just a quirky way to do what we strive to do always, and that is to connect artists with audiences, and that pertains to Baltimore music as well. It's a big part of what we do.
So I'm trying to picture this. I don't travel as much as I used to. I don't hang around a lot around the luggage carousel.
Well, we're going to change that.
And of course, and like a lot of people, I try not to check bags if right. I can avoid if it's a short trip, right? So paint the scene for
sure.
me. Where does this actually happen at BWI?
Well, we are making Baggage Carousel Number 5 the Friday night hotspot now in Baltimore.
Baggage Carousel Number 5.
Number 5. It's the place to be. And I tell every band, every artist that we've booked that this will be one of the most unique and odd gigs you ever play, and it has been. It's an audience unlike any other venue. They're obviously not there for the music. And at one minute, you may have 150 people standing there watching the band while they're waiting for the baggage carousel to start. And then the baggage comes out, they grab their bags and they're gone, and then it's kind of empty again. And you have people, and you know how people walk through airports, you know, everybody's in a hurry and they're determined and focused and they're dragging their luggage behind them. And you've got these people scurrying back and forth. And I've seen so many people do that. And literally, you can see them physically stopped in their tracks. They will stop and look up like, oh, my gosh, what is this? So they're so taken aback by it. And they'll stop and they'll enjoy it. And they'll break out the cell phone cameras and they'll start, you know, sending pictures to their friends. And it's just been tremendous success. It's been a whole lot of fun, and it's really getting ahead of steam this year, I think. Now, people can actually come there just to see the band, because it's in the baggage claim area.
I was just going to ask that, because you said a minute ago, obviously people are not there just for the music. Is that changing? I mean, you do this once a month.
We do it the last Friday of the month, yes.
The last Friday of the month.
Mm-hmm. Now, people can come see the band, and they do. But, you know, most of the people are scurrying back and forth, traveling through. But bands do bring their fans. And it's easy in, easy out. You don't have to go through security. You can park your vehicle, walk in, check out the band for a while, and head to the car and get out. It's easy in and out.
And it's free. What's the appeal for musicians?
The uniqueness of it. They've really latched on to the sort of bizarre idea of playing at an airport terminal.
We've just got a couple minutes, but Animal Collection,
Animal Collective,
a local band with an international following, actually debuted an album at BWI.
Yeah, that
is a short version of that.
Yes, so the BWI Live, WTMD presents BWI Live, is actually two components: the live events we were just talking about, and then we also curate and program the soundtrack that plays throughout the airport 24/7, and it's all Baltimore and DC artists. So the bands were looking for a unique way to debut their album. They caught wind of this, and we helped facilitate that. They played it unannounced for 24 hours, starting the day before Thanksgiving, the busiest travel day of the year, and social media exploded. It was covered by Rolling Stone, Spin, Pitchfork, Stereo Gum, on and
so
on.
So now the bands are calling you.
Bands are calling
us. You don't have to beg bands to do this.
That's true. Bands are calling us now.
Scott Mullins, I really appreciate your telling us about this. Jen Wassner of Y Oak is next in the lineup at BWI. If you happen to be traveling between 7 p.m. and 10 p.m. on February 12th.
Yeah, no, that's the exception. I've sat here and said
it's the last Friday.
She's Friday. The exception to accommodate everyone's schedule. We were glad to do it. So February 12th, Jen
Wassner. That's next Friday. Mm-hmm. If you want to head to BWI just for the concert, head to Baggage Carousel 5. We'll have links with more information on the Midday Show page for WIPR.org, and we'll hear Jen Wassner as we wrap up the show. I want to thank all of our guests for being part of our Friday News Roundup. I want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers, locations and hours at joesquared.com. I want to thank you for listening. Tune in Monday for a conversation with Diane Rehm about her new very personal memoir, On My Own. I'm Sheila Cast. I hope you have a great weekend. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.